Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
We find, as we look into the matter, that ERA won't give women anything which they haven't already got or have a way of getting. But on the other hand, it will take away from women some of the most important rights and benefits and exemptions we now have.
What would be an example of that?
Well, a great glaring example on which there is full agreement between both the proponents and the opponents is the matter of the draft. Women are exempt from the draft. Selective service says only young men of age 18 have to register. But the Equal Rights Amendment will positively make women subject to the draft and on an equal basis with men.
That's the late Phyllis Schlafly, regular guest here on this program, making her case against the Equal Rights Amendment way back in 1973 on the firing line with William F. Buckley. She's passed away. Now, if you ignore social media and simply read the obituaries, you might get an accurate picture of her life and her contribution. What's been left out? What has been included by way of both those who would praise her and those who were her critics? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, September the 8th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly joins us to talk about media coverage of the life of the late Phyllis Schlafly. After that, we'll spend some time with Dr. Ken Sherb. We'll be talking with him in our series, Martin Luther and the Reformation, Part 36. We're going to move on to Luther's preaching, beginning with Luther's treatment of the Sermon on the Mount, dealing with a couple verses there. Then, Bishop Keith Ackerman joins us. There is an open letter to Church of England bishops to accept gay members and leaders. It calls for unequivocal acceptance of these members and leaders. We'll see what Bishop Ackerman thinks about it and how likely it is that the ruling bishops there in the Church of England will acquiesce to this demand. Then it's time for Christ in the Old Testament with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. We'll again be in the book of Isaiah, this time in chapters 17 and 18. You can join us with your questions or your comments over the next 2 hours of the program. Our call-in number 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Or you can just send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. For those who listen on demand, you are always welcome to call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He joins us to talk about media coverage of the life of the late Phyllis Schlafly, especially the obituary coverage. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. He's also founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
What can we learn so far from the obituaries of Phyllis Schlafly about journalism and the current state of the media?
Well, first of all, there's a sense in which obituaries are ordinary news reports. I mean, in the sense that they announce an event. In that sense, it's not surprising that you might see a kind of a debate in that story about a person's life and career. There are people who are incredibly offended by the presence of any negative material in an obituary about public figures. I'm not one of those people. I figure any life worth living in the public arena probably stirred up quite a bit of debate, and it's not surprising that you have people with different points of view. In the Schlafly debates, and I say this frankly as someone who never was particularly a fan of Phyllis Schlafly, yet someone who kind of admired her impact in the sense that anybody who makes people that furious, sometimes on both sides of issues, has probably got a lot of talent. And I want to come back to that issue of talent. But on the question of what it tells us about journalism, I think it's best to look at obituaries of controversial figures. When they appear in a newsroom, it's a chance to see what causes and values that newsroom endorses and which ones do not. Ironically, the more critical a newsroom is of a person, critical as in negative, the more likely you are to see a story that resembles a classic 50-50 American presentation of a debate about a controversial issue. You're likely to see a lot of balance when you're dealing with the death of a major figure on the moral, cultural, or political right. However, in a lot of newsrooms, especially if you're looking at, say, the Washington Post or the New York Times, you're much less likely to see large amounts of material from articulate, qualified critics of that person when it's a figure on the cultural left. Thus, in the piece I wrote on Schlafly's obituaries in the Post and the Times, I mentioned that if you wanted to try to get some sort of comparison, if Gloria Steinem were to die today, you would probably read reviews that featured the views of people who were kind of like wild critics, who had very extreme things to say about her. You're probably less likely to read kind of low-key, informed, critical scholars talking about whether feminism had accomplished what it set out to accomplish, or even whether she was a good example of what the feminists held out as their idea. In other words, you're more likely to read serious criticism of figures who are opposed by that newspaper than you are to read serious criticism of the heroes of that newspaper. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what did you find in the Washington Post's obituary for Phyllis Schlafly?
Well, the main thing, it's interesting, I got feedback on my post where people couldn't tell if I was attacking the Post piece or praising it. I was simply kind of noting it was what it was. But there were two things that I thought the news piece could have used. First of all, very high in the story, there was this moment when it said, I'll read it, a champion of traditional stay-at-home roles for women, Mrs. Schlafly opposed the ERA because she believed it would open the door to same-sex marriage, abortion, the draft for women, co-ed, more accurate would have been unisex, bathrooms, and the end of labor laws that barred women from dangerous workplaces. I thought it would have been kind of interesting at some point to have actually taken a look at that list of her predictions and allowed people to react to them in light of trends since that time. The more important thing was that Phyllis Schlafly was someone who won her individual battle, but ultimately lost the war, because we live in a culture where, as the old saying goes, politics is downstream from culture. And religious conservatives of her type have absolutely zero standing in the cultural spheres that matter the most. And for me, that would be Hollywood and the law schools of Harvard and Yale. So no matter what victory she won on the ERA, to some degree, her victory was doomed by the fact that she didn't have clout in the segments of our society where actual cultural change takes place. Politicians usually end up verifying what is done first in popular culture and in the law schools that put people on the Supreme Court.
I want you to go a little deeper into that. And do you think that's acknowledged in the Washington Post obituary, that significant victory in, as you said, the battle, but not in the war?
No, I don't think that ended up being covered very well in the story. They never followed up on that list. But let me give you another area that I feel you could have illustrated it and taken it deeper. Inside the Republican Party, inside the tent of the Republican Party, to use the late William F. Buckley's image, you have cultural liberals as well as cultural conservatives. The story, that and the New York Times, made it seem like this was a woman who was universally beloved on the political right or at least among Republicans, that she was a hero who helped create the religious right and thus was someone Republicans all looked up to and admired. Well, I mean, just having covered these issues for a couple of decades, I can tell you that is simply not the case. If you went looking for them, you could probably find Republicans who absolutely detested Phyllis Schlafly and everything she stood for, because the woman was, the way I put it in the post, the woman was a rebel against the country club Republican establishment. She was someone who came out of that world, but ultimately represented a serious attack on kind of the rich country club, highly educated, prominent school world within the Republican Party, which tends to be the more culturally liberal side of the party and kind of the most traditionally conservative economically when it comes to matters of Wall Street or spending or whatever. So she was a rebel against her own class in that sense. And I thought it would have been interesting for someone to have dug a little deeper and to have noted that. After all, it's the Republican Party in which there are no moral absolutes on issues such as abortion, gay rights, and the other great hot-button issues of our day. There are absolute truths in the Democratic Party. You cannot run for national office in the Democratic Party now without saluting certain absolute truths when it comes to moral and cultural issues. The uncertainty remains in the Republicans, and I thought it would have been interesting to have critiqued her or to have found some people willing to critique her in that manner.
There was also a subtlety in her critique of feminism and in her alternative to feminism, why she thought women were doing better in the late 20th century, early 21st century, that escape a lot of people. Talk about that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly of which one you're talking about. She kept saying that she thought women, when they were placed in a traditional cultural environment with loyal husbands, families, etc., that they actually had a role in life that was more than affirmed, protected, and exalted. Of course, that's language guaranteed to infuriate people whose lifeblood is encapsulated in saying, like, a woman needs a man the way a fish needs a bicycle. So she, one of her greatest talents was simply causing people to freak out in the mainstream. And sometimes that's useful because people say things when they're mad. They display levels of candor that they might not have otherwise. But tell me more about what you're thinking, and then let me react to that.
Well, and I find it just absolutely fascinating. She talked, rather than attribute the improvement in women's standing in society and in their basically their quality of living to feminism per se, she attributed it to technology. She said, look, life in working in the home is a lot easier than it was 100 years ago because of the technology. We don't have feminism to thank for that.
Well, that's interesting, although, you know, I bet if you push, you would find a lot of female professionals and scientists who are responsible for a lot of that technology.
Absolutely.
Which kind of brings us around the horn to the other great irony that people love to point out, and I think it's a perfectly wonderful thing to note. We're talking about an incredibly brilliant professional woman sustaining a lengthy career outside the home, both in public life, alternative publishing, fundraising, politics, etc. A person who, at points in her life, there were people who said it appeared her husband's primary job was helping take care of her career in some ways, although he was wealthy in his own right. Schlafly could, I think, be criticized for functioning as precisely the kind of woman that she was not glorifying in a lot of her public remarks in terms of the women that she praised. It certainly would have to be an irony that would figure in any intelligent obituary of her life and career.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the life of the late Phyllis Schlafly. When we come back, we'll talk about the social media freak out.
the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, hear us, Savior, hear us who
the 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The people of Zion Lutheran Church, East Moline, Illinois, invite you to discover the blessings that await you here. At Zion, we proclaim a gospel of free grace for all. No one ever falls too low to find forgiveness and peace with God in Christ Jesus. To learn more, visit us at zionem.com or join us on Sunday at 9 a.m. Zion is located at 17618 Hubbard Road in rural East Moline, Illinois.
Over and over again, I tried to let the entire book reflect this, that the holiness of all the saints is only the holiness of Jesus reflected in their lives.
Pastor Will Wheaton, author of the new book, Celebrating the Saints.
And this holiness of Christ is the thing which the saints grabbed onto in faith, and it illumined their lives.
You can purchase Celebrating the Saints by calling 1-800-325-3040 or at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about media coverage of the life of the late Phyllis Schlafly with Terry Mattingly of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. Terry, let's talk about what you called earlier the freak out. If you look at social media, it's in display all over the place with the death of Phyllis Schlafly, kind of showing that she has that talent and ability both in life and death to invoke that angry candor you were talking about. How would you describe it?
Well, this is why I said I wanted to focus on the word talent. At some point, people who attempt to lead social causes must deal with the reality that they must increase their footprint in public media and in public debate. And the world of talented Republican political activists who used to be highly active in mainstream press. For example, if you go to Washington, D.C., and you deal with Democrats in the Senate and in the House of Reps and in their think tanks, they have long, long lists of extremely talented former media professionals who are now their connections to the Post. I always like to say, you know, that there are a lot of political people, political specialists at the Washington Post, that when they get a call from the Democratic Party, the odds are good that they're getting a call from one of their former editors or from a journalist at some other publication or network that they probably wish they could have worked for at some point. In effect, they're getting calls from journalists they respect telling them that these are valid stories. When they get calls from Republican activists, they're getting calls from people who have come up totally in the world of alternative conservative think tanks, publications, academia, or just strictly through politics and politics alone. In other words, when the Democrats call you and ask you to cover a story, you're getting a call from a former boss, a friend, or somebody with a resume you respect. When a Republican calls you up, you're getting a call quite literally from an enemy. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Who is more likely to kind of win the battle of convincing you of the accuracy or worthiness of their point of view, or the worthiness of the event or trend they want you to cover. Now, Schlafly pushed it all the way to the other extreme. She became the villain whose quotes you simply had to run. They were so colorful. They were so off the chart, amusing at times. She said things that in any newsroom would be recognized as a killer quote. And the people in the newsroom might have thought, oh, man, that's ridiculous. I got to run that. From Schlafly's perspective, all she cares is that you run it. And that out there in the heartland, people watching the networks and people reading these things in their publications, they'll respond to her words in their own way. She just had the talent of getting out there. In many ways, even more than someone like, say, a Jerry Falwell, or someone like, dare I compare her to Pat Robertson, who has the ability to say things that turn out to be absolutely brilliantly wrong in so many cases. Whereas Schlafly said things that made you uncomfortable, and the left wanted to say, oh, that's impossible. But for people who weren't already ideologically committed to the feminist position, they're thinking, actually, I could see these people creating unisex bathrooms. I could see these people wanting to draft women and then put them in combat. I could see these people thinking that same-sex marriage is possible and a positive thing. So in that sense, she had the talent to make herself impossible to ignore. And I've often wondered if that was a reflection of her Phi Beta Kappa college career and her graduation from a secular law school. I imagine that walking around on any secular law school campus, she couldn't have just been a normal person sitting at the lunch tables. Does that make sense? I mean, she had to understand how other people talked about her and reacted to her, and she honed that into an art and then used it to gain a larger footprint in public life.
Did any of those obituaries that you perused, did they either implicitly or explicitly acknowledge her prescience when it comes to those issues? Because on a lot of those things, if not all of them, she was proven beyond right.
I haven't seen any yet, but I did see, but in the obituaries that I covered and some of the others that I read, I did see them using quotes from saying, this woman was brilliant at what she did. Now, that would be something that could be said even by people who absolutely, totally detested her message or what she had to say. They could still recognize this was one of the most important conservative cultural activists of her era. If all you did was say she was one of the creators of the religious right, that would put her in a small, very important crowd of cultural and political activists. But hey, think about this. Name me other religious right figures who took on an issue and won. How long is that list?
Two final questions for you, Terry.
You didn't answer.
Because it's a pretty short list.
it's not going to take a long time to discuss it. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm harassing you. Go ahead.
On the issue of winning, she did win that battle against the Equal Rights Amendment at the time when feminism was really getting its sea legs, so to speak, when it had its strongest public proponents, and they were still young and vital and all of those kinds of things. Do any of the obituaries hint on how she won that battle, if only that battle?
Well, I think the point is that she won with the women of that day. But once again, let me stress, this is a woman who didn't seem to take very seriously the degree to which the redefining of what it meant to be a woman was not taking place in the living room of Gloria Steinem. It was taking place at the shopping mall. And to some degree, she beat Gloria Steinem but lost to Madonna. And lost to MTV. and lost to rap video and lost to the shopping mall stores that every fall successfully tell young women, including those from supposedly conservative religious homes, tells them what they're supposed to look like if they will be cool, and what they're supposed to act like if they're going to be hot and attractive and cool and hot at the same time, obviously is not a cultural contradiction in our society. To some degree, she failed to realize that she wasn't in a political battle alone. She was in a battle against principalities and powers of entertainment, culture, smartphones, shopping malls, credit cards, and all of the other ways in which America tells us how we're supposed to live. And you know what? She's not alone with that. There are a lot of suburban megachurches that don't seem to have a clue at the impact of popular culture on the lives of people in their parishes, in their congregations, in those auditorium rock show-sized church buildings, while they actually, to some degree, photocopy that culture in their own worship, in their own life, sometimes in their own retreats and Christian education. Phyllis Schlafly probably didn't understand the degree to which what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a mother and what it means to have a family was being redefined through those vehicles, much more so than what was coming out in legislation. She won one battle. I'm not sure she even saw the other one.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Ken Cherb, continuing our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Part 36, we'll be looking at Luther's treatment of the Sermon on the Mount.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
You're invited to a special service commemorating the 160th anniversary of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. It's a Vespers service beginning at 4 on Saturday afternoon, September the 10th. I have the honor of preaching for this anniversary celebration. Worship in one of the most beautiful sanctuaries in Greater St. Louis, Saturday, September the 10th, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel. If you want to stay for dinner, RSVP 618-633-2209.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit WittenbergAcademy.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300: Pilgrim Lutheran, Santa Monica, California; Emmanuel Lutheran, Terre Haute, Indiana; Trinity Lutheran, San Angelo, Texas; Trinity Lutheran and Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota; St. John Lutheran, Schaumburg, Illinois; Our Savior Lutheran, Pipestone, Minnesota; Real Lutheran Fellowship, Rochester, Minnesota; Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas; St. James Lutheran, Logansport, Indiana; St. John's Lutheran, State Center, Iowa; and Trinity Lutheran, West Chicago, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.